Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. Mass migration is one of the markers of our era. Today, about 184 million people live outside their country of nationality. More than 110 million people have been forcibly displaced. About one-third are refugees. Coping with all this movement in humane and just ways is both a huge challenge and increasingly a hot potato. In destination countries like Europe and the United States, concerns about migration are being weaponized. In a year when something like half the people on Earth will be voting in national or regional elections, migration seems to be on the ballot as much as democracy itself. How should migrants, refugees, asylum seekers be treated? How to balance political forces and legal commitments? Can what looks like a competition to harden borders be reversed? And from where will the leadership come for better policy? I don't know if my guest today has answers, but if anyone has an inkling of a path forward, Sergio Carrera probably does. He is an expert on migration policy in general and in Europe in particular. He works at the Center for European Policy Studies in Brussels and a half a dozen other places. Welcome, Sergio, to New Thinking for a New World.
Thank you, Alan. It's my pleasure to participate in this conversation.
Sergio, Europe is a magnet for people fleeing war, unrest, bad economics. Migrants are a magnet for politicians seeking votes from citizens unhappy about those migrants. As a policy guy, do you think it's possible to avoid a downward, worst-case competition?
Yes, I absolutely think so. You know, after so many years, indeed, dealing with this topic, an increasingly politically salient topic, I do believe that it raises very fundamental questions regarding the founding principles, the universal values that makes us human. It really a conversation that poses very profound questions as to the extent to which these values are still respected, are still a priority, that migration policy is not different from other policies. At the end of the day, these are people, these are human beings, and as such should be treated. And I think this is one of the most fundamental issues at stake, the extent to which these principles are still to be upheld and safeguarded no matter what.
The irony is that in one sense, despite what I said a few moments ago, the actual numbers are not huge. It always depends what the denominator is compared to what, but compared to global population, compared to global movement, compared to travel, something on the order, I think, of a couple hundred thousand people tried to get into Europe last year, dramatically less than a few years ago. What is it about the moment that has so sharpened the reaction to migration? And indeed, as you suggested, wildly violating any sense of universal values, justice, humanity.
It is a conversation that too often we find ourselves in a discussion about numbers, which hide people, in fact, hide human beings. And you're right when reading the global context as one where the big human movements are not coming to Western countries and certainly not to the European Union. What research shows very clearly is that in those countries which are the main, let's say, hosts or origin of refugees, the people either stay internally displaced or they move to neighboring countries. They don't continue their journeys. The picture that is often portrayed, presenting Western countries as the main desired destination, it is simply untrue. It is simply untrue. So we need to always take distance when, you know, facing or reading numbers that frame the phenomenon as something that is simply false. And politically, this has been misused. I mean, it's a scapegoat. It's the scapegoat, one of them, of nowadays. Certain human beings, because of the simple fact of being labeled as migrants, between quotation marks, are simply dehumanized. some politicians and policymakers consider that they have less responsibility towards those people, that the human rights of those people are negotiable. And this is should not be accepted, because at the end of the day, it affects us all. Who is and who is not a migrant is a very subjective question sometimes, and one that is often fraught with discrimination and racism as well.
Well, to be practical, we've seen that recently in Europe with the Ukrainian diaspora, which was at least initially embraced certainly by neighbor countries to a degree that has not happened for migrants, refugees, asylum seekers from either the Middle East wars or the African problems. Let me segue, though, to Europe. You co-authored a study last year that said, which I found an amazing statement, some EU states, and I quote, have chosen to act systematically and instrumentally outside the law and their legal commitments. That's an extraordinary statement, but it's an extraordinary description of what at the end of the day is illegal border controls inside the Union. How did we get there? How did you get there?
I mean, firstly, it is true that the European Union response to human displacements from the war in Ukraine, you know, needs to be welcomed and praised. It, however, raises also many questions regarding discrimination as well. Why people fleeing wars and conflicts from other regions in the world have not been granted temporary protection as well? And that's why I mentioned before, why is it that this is becoming an accepted way of doing policy? You mentioned the finding in our study. Why governments seem to be, or seem to consider themselves in a position, in a legitimate position, not to comply with the law. At the end of the day, many times, Alan, I feel that when we are, we go into a conversation, a political debate about migration, many instances made me think that the real issue at stake is the rule of law. You know, how are those governments actually doing in many other policy areas? Why are those politicians and political parties paying so much attention to this area? For which political gains? And how do they relate to checks and balances in a liberal democracy? Meaning, how are they kept accountable? You mentioned some policies we are seeing across the world, pushbacks. These pushbacks entail basically not considering that those people have a right to be considered as people, to be assessed. Who are they? Are they, you know, do they have any vulnerability? Are they victim of trafficking? Is it an obligation not to expel those people back? Because, you know, they could be subject to inhuman and degrading treatment. So this is what is happening at the moment. We are seeing a systematic, indeed, culture across the world and also in Europe, in the European Union, of practicing, you know, really violent policies against people. They are very well documented, and they are clearly simply not only illegal, but unethical in nature.
Six countries in Europe have had illegal internal border controls for at least the last 7 years. Austria, Denmark, France, Germany, Norway, Sweden. And two of those, of course, are the largest, most important, air quotes, geopolitical actors in Europe, Germany and France. Why are they allowed to get away with policies that even they don't defend as legal? They simply ignore their illegality.
I mean, there is a lack of enforcement in the European Union. There is this is a responsibility of the European Commission. The European Commission has the role to guarantee the treaties, the European Union treaties, the compliance by governments of EU law. And this is simply, it has not happened because this has been an extremely politicized topic. You mentioned some of the key EU member states that have been basically misbehaving, not complying with their obligations in this area, but also not, most fundamentally, not really proving based on evidence, how these internal border controls are in any way or form useful to respond to the phenomena that they are referring to. And let's not forget that one of the key achievements that is highly valuable by European citizens is free movement area, meaning a unilateral decision by a government to apply internal border controls has far-reaching implications for the sustainability of the identity of the European Union itself. This doesn't mean, however, that the Schengen area is in crisis. This we also have concluded in our research. Schengen is not in crisis. What is actually happening is indeed those few governments you mentioned simply not complying with their legal obligations and the European Commission not bringing those countries, those governments, the countries are laughing to the governments, before the courts to oblige them to basically, you know, follow what they agreed, what they bound themselves to follow. So this is my reading of the situation, and it is about time for those ministries of interior in the relevant countries to basically play by the rules and, systematically comply with their obligations in this area.
I would certainly agree they ought to, but I don't see any dynamic coming out of the EU leadership to force them to. And in that context, I wanted to ask you about Libya and Tunisia. The EU has in both cases, and widely celebrated as a potential solution, created environments where they're going to provide aid and assistance to those two states. They are providing assistance to Libya and Tunisia to strengthen their capacity to prevent people from departing across the Mediterranean towards Europe. Is that legal? Going to your rule of law question. It is being celebrated all over the place in other countries, the UK, Rwanda, the United States, Mexico. Lots of other countries are looking at it and saying, wow, this is a good solution. What do you think?
I mean, the European Commission has been widely criticized, European Commission president, for striking a deal with the Tunisian authorities without the necessary, green light from all the relevant actors, including some governments in the European Union. And one, wonders what is the democratic legitimacy of the European Commission president to go and conclude a deal with a country which actually has enormous implications for the entire Union, and where we have very little understanding of the impact of that money, of funds, how funds are going to impact more largely democracy, rule of law, conditions, how these funds, which give priority to migration management, in fact may negatively influence or including nurture rule of law backsliding in those societies, the impacts on human rights as well. Also, many of those deals are adopted in non-legally binding instruments by choice, which means that there is no parliamentary control by national parliaments, by the European Parliament. There is no democratic accountability of what is adopted precisely, which also raises a question of the lack of legitimacy of these deals. So I will very much raise a big question mark as to the extent to which there is actually consensus regarding the value and the effectiveness of these instruments, and also the use of the European Commission funds to persuade neighboring countries to contain asylum. If anything we've learned in research over the last years, it simply doesn't work. I mean, those countries know that what is the interest of the European Commission and some EU governments regarding migration management, and they use it in their foreign affairs relations with both bilaterally and with the EU as well, in kind of a reverse kind of a way in their relations. So it makes actually the EU vulnerable to those countries. If anything, we've learned with Turkey, for example, the Turkish government the same thing. So very big question mark regarding the effectiveness and also underline that there is still a lot of discussion as to whether this should be the way to, you know, to continue doing policy in this area.
Another approach that is becoming popular is to find a partner country that you can send migrants to that will house migrants you don't want in your country. The case study, the moment, of course, is Italy's attempt to organize that relationship with Albania, which Prime Minister Meloni described as, quote, a truly European agreement and an historic agreement for the EU, both of which statements are sort of amazing. I know that the Albanian Supreme Court has held up the implementation of the deal for the moment, but how should we think about that kind of policy, which, as I mentioned a moment ago, is also UK policy also held up vis-a-vis Rwanda?
We have examples around the world that have tried a similar approach. I'm thinking of Australia, the offshoring program in Australia, and there are very important lessons learned, not least that these policies do not deter people from trying. People who really, you know, are forced to flee, they will still try. They don't have a chance. They don't have a choice. And also they leave, to a very large extent, they lead to arbitrary detention and inhuman and degrading treatment in the countries with which, you know, that they take their responsibility. This has been really clearly the case in the case of Australia. So when it comes to the EU, these ideas are simply, unfeasible. Both in law and in practice. You mentioned the initiative of the Italian government. Let's not forget that we have the Italian government is led by far-right coalition. And these ideas, we need to be very much aware of this. The Tunisian deal also was, in that photo, was European Commission president, the Italian government prime minister, and the Dutch prime minister. So it is backed up by a far right government. So we need to see where these ideas find appeal currently in the European Union. Now, when it comes to feasibility, it is clear that based on the experiences that and the research we've done, what it means is forcing people against their will to be brought to a country where they have no link whatsoever, detaining them there by force, and then with the hope, and that's the false hope, then what do we do with these people? What to do with those people? In the sense that they cannot be easily returned to their countries of origin, many of them for many legitimate reasons, and that is, this is not possible. So then we find ourselves in cases with lengthy detention, you know, mistreatment, horrendous reception conditions, and so forth. And simply put, governments cannot get away with their responsibility. There's no way that in the European context, particularly where we have the European Convention on Human Rights, the human rights apply even abroad. You know, they follow. This is a portable, we call it like a portable justice, portable responsibility, meaning that even if those people are brought to Albania, Italian authorities still have jurisdiction and are still responsible for those people. By the way, also the Albanian authorities. Let's see what will happen in implementation in terms of, you know, if things go wrong and there are human rights violations, who is going to be responsible? There may be cases of co-responsibility by Albanian authorities and Italian authorities. So the picture is not very pretty. And that's why in our research, we have concluded that this memorandum of understanding between Italy and Albania is a worst practice. It's a worst practice in migration policy. It is certainly not a European response. It was a unilateral decision by the Italian government. It has not been backed up by the European Union in any way or form. And as such, it should be read.
Thanks for listening so far. I hope you're enjoying the conversation as much as I have. If you haven't already, please subscribe on the platform of your choice and rate us on Apple Podcast. Now back to today's discussion, sponsored by the Stavros Niarchos Foundation, SNF. What segue to the European Union's attempt to normalize policy? As you know much better than I, there's been a long negotiation that between the Commission, within the Commission, with the member states, over trying to recapture the migration flag from member states and bringing it back to some kind of coherent European policy. And there was an announcement in December with great fanfare that there was an agreement. Now, that agreement, I understand, is still needs a lot of definition. But can you, and has been criticized widely already by almost everybody in the business from the NGO side as to its content, its implications, and so on. Let's start with the overall assessment. Is this progress?
I mean, I watched...
And I apologize for the impossible question. And of course, you're trying to be a little diplomatic. And we're trying to grasp onto something, some positive here that we can build on. But is this a positive on which something can be built?
I mean, the question is, for me, really, the question is, does the new pact on migration and asylum really ensure equal sharing of responsibility between EU member states and a model that is compliant with EU values? That's, for me, the key question. Because if the answer is no, then we haven't done any progress. Meaning, one of the key, let's say, ideas coming out of this pact is the notion of flexible solidarity, which means that EU member state governments are given the possibility to pick and choose their responsibilities when it comes to assessing asylum seekers' applications. Let's not forget the pact does not abolish the rule that still applies nowadays, according to which responsibility is determined to the government where a person enters first in European Union territory irregularly. And this has created an enormous debate on why countries in the EU holding EU external borders have more responsibility than other countries, you know, in other parts of the European Union. The pact does not abolish this rule. It will still apply. And not only that, it will often a pick and choose approach, a la carte approach for governments to say, well, we don't really want to relocate, to participate in relocation of asylum seekers from Greece, from Spain, from Poland. But actually, we just want to, you know, pay our contribution, give some funds here and there, you know, help capacity here and there. To me, this does not sound as a fair sharing of responsibility between all EU member states in a common area of asylum. It doesn't. And on top of that, and that's the second point, that brings me back to the original, the preliminary introduction of our conversation, that the pact has a lot of difficulties to comply with EU values. I mean, if you look at the priorities driving this pact, it's only making life of people more and more and more difficult, particularly of asylum seekers and refugees. It is not true that a big majority of people that arrive irregularly at EU external borders are not legitimate asylum seekers and refugees. Those people need to have access to an individual assessment. And this is not always the case, particularly outside border crossing points, you know, in border surveillance through land and sea borders. This is where pushbacks are happening. People are basically subject to accelerated expulsions without having, and sometimes cases of violence, physical violence and mistreatment, without having the possibility to apply for asylum. So now the application of border procedures at EU external borders is going to lead to more containment, to more detention. So you refer to civil society. I mean, it's been an overwhelming call for attention, you know, a wake-up call by NGOs all across Europe. Say, please don't adopt this pact in this way. This is going to create more problem, not only for people involved, but also for governments. They will have more responsibilities. Those at the EU external borders, they will have more responsibilities. So it's not only NGOs, it's academia at large has been raising very profound questions about this. Do we really need this pact on migration? What does this mean? And coming back to EU values, are we sacrificing the founding principles of the European Union in this field? And this is a particularly serious question for all of us to consider based on recent history in Europe of people being targeted and persecuted based on their status, attributed status, origin. Why is it that we are moving uncritically by all political parties? Because here we had the EPP, the socialists, the liberals, going along with an agenda that is playing the card of legitimizing, mistreating people because they are simply labeled as migrants. And this for me is a very crucial point for anyone working on human rights to focus on these people who are moving because they are forced to move and to ensure that they are treated with dignity, with equality, and that they have access to the safety they deserve. And certainly the EU should not congratulate itself with this pact on migration and asylum, not least because the absent from this pact, you know who that is? Those who will be impacted by these policies. These are the silent voices who have not been part of this decision making, the people who will be ultimately affected by restrictive policies. And indeed, it's very sad. It's very sad that we are seeing some EU policymakers self-congratulating themselves about this achievement, when in my view, you know, we will see what happens. Certainly the rules are not very promising and implementation on the ground is neither very, clear how this is going to help anybody, frankly.
Presumably the EU leadership, national leadership, is responding not to the criticisms coming from civil society, but from what they read as the political preferences of their voters. This is an election year. We have EU elections in June. Every forecast I have seen suggests that the center left is likely to lose to the center right in terms of the shift inside the parliament. We've seen it in the Netherlands. We've seen in other countries this dynamic moving from the left towards the right. And every time one of those polls is reported, another politician stands up and encourages the kind of policies. He doesn't say, I want you to violate EU values, because there is no discussion of EU values in the public domain. There is in among the NGOs, but not in the public domain. How do you flip that dialogue? How do you flip that debate in a way that would create support for the kinds of policies that you correctly say would be consistent with EU values, EU traditions, and just to be practical, would probably be more effective than these things which imaginative policy guys are popping out of the toaster right and left that simply don't work?
So a very excellent point. And I feel that it has played a role. When I was watching the press conference of all the members of the European Parliament that have been co-rapporteurs on the files of the pact, and I'm sure they've done their best, and they've, you know, had perhaps very meaningful intentions. However, they need to be also aware of the major impact that they are having and will have by signing up to a pact that finds appeal in political parties that foster an openly discriminatory and racist agenda. Now, political preferences, of course, are to be considered, but should they be sacrificed for our principles? And that, for me, that's the key question. Why to sacrifice? Is the sacrificing of our principles, of our liberal democratic principles, you know, in the menu, in a context of evolving political preferences and changing political preferences, what is the impact on that? Certain views which should not be legitimized, full stop, even if short term there may be negative electoral results? Are they thinking on the medium, the long-term impact of the policies that are being adopted, the kind of narrative and discourse that is being used? You know, I have the feeling sometimes they forget we are talking about human beings with equal rights and dignity. So, and understanding that we all lose with this kind of, political opportunism of showing we are doing something. Who is winning with this? Really? Who is really winning with this? I am not sure. I'm really not sure. It's not just the civil society. You know, you have really a wealth of academics. We have one project, which is called Asyl Project, that is funded by the EU. We've had an in-depth conversation with academics across Europe, around the world, also raising these same questions. And I wonder sometimes where these EU policymakers, in which reality are they living? Aren't they seeing that by playing that card, they are, you know, providing ground to extremely problematic understandings of who is a human being?
Let me add just one dimension to that that you mentioned earlier, which is the rule of law. Arguably, if you can degrade and even ignore the rule of law in some spaces that are politically popular, you run the risk that the same thing could happen in spaces that may not be so politically popular. So a corollary of what goes on in this arena dealing with them, with the foreigners, not with us, could potentially come back to bite people who are enthusiastic for at least the moment about some of these policies. Is that fair?
Absolutely fair. Just to clarify, the rule of law is not an empty shell. It's not an empty concept. It's true, we have different traditions around the world, different historical backgrounds and traditions and on the rule of law, but at the very minimum, in Europe, there is consensus in the Council of Europe, but also now in European Union. What are the building blocks? And here is not just, you know, very basic safeguard, respecting the law, legal certainty, but also access to justice, having a civil society, independent civil society space, independent judiciary, having checks and balances, democratic control, accountability. You know, these checks and balances are fundamental. A migration policy is no different of other policies in this regard. And when you say this affects everybody, we are seeing it in several European countries. I mean, look at Hungary. The Hungarian government policies, a very good example. A government with an open agenda, very clear agenda, transparent, anti-migration, anti-refugee, anti-everything agenda that ultimately is negatively affecting the entire population, the entire citizenry, with other communities being affected, other groups, LGBTY groups, NGOs work, the justice system. I mean, you name it. It kind of derails completely. This is a major risk. That's what I was saying, that for me, many times when politicians and governments make use of the migration card, as citizens, we should be actually, this should be an alarm. Say, why are they focusing so much on this? Particularly, as you said before, statistically, it's not very relevant sometimes in terms of pure numbers. Why is it that they put this at front? Is there anything they're trying to hide in terms of their, how are they behaving themselves in terms of their own commitments as a government towards their citizens? In other policies, social policies, education policy, employment policy, poverty, and so forth. Is this an indicator that something is wrong more fundamentally than the issue at hand? So it should really make us think. And then who is these migrants they are talking about? who is those people? I often ask policymakers, but who do you have in mind? How does that person look like? And the answers you can imagine. I mean, most often we end up, and I'm going to be quite open, highly racist framings of who do they have in mind. So questions of institutionalized racism, how are we going about that? How are we going about governments that are openly making statements that are targeting certain groups in society, that are part of society already, and our communities? So this is for me what is really at stake. And that is why in our work, in our research, we try to bring it back there. We try to bring it back to, you know, governance, how states and so-called leaders comply with their own commitments as leaders and do not backslide in their own accountability and responsibility.
Sergio, those are important questions. I fear they're rhetorical questions at the moment. We're going to see what voters think this year, and I confess that I am not as optimistic as I would like to be about the answers the voters are going to give us. But what we know for sure is that the kind of work you are doing, that your institution is doing, is terribly important to try to get people to focus on exactly those rhetorical questions of humanity, dignity, and rule of law. So thank you, Sergio, for this conversation. And let's hope. Let's just hope.
Let's hope. And for me, frankly, just to also end, rhetorical questions, but that have enormous practical impact when you see somebody and look at the person at the eye. So they are rhetorical, but they also have an enormous human face. And having that in mind is what we might call.
Sergio, thank you very much. Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.